I take my place in the shadowy booth and order the only thing I can. A single shot of fermented mead from Geonosis. It has taken me months to drink the whole bottle, but I tip Wu-Her for keeping it around. There are only a few shots left. Worms sloshing around at the bottom of the green liquid. I dip in my snout and take a dainty sip, tasting hundreds of other mouths on the dirty glass. I can hear almost everything said in this cantina, and by afternoon, I've heard nothing of the droids. I slurp up the worm at the bottom of my glass and leave. Just another hooded figure disappearing through Wu-Her's door. Outside, I do something I rarely do, and take a full breath through my snout, drawing in every scent for blocks. Pain throbs behind my eyes. It's too much. This place is too crowded, too filthy, too full of flesh. I follow the scent of hot metal, but it's just another Jawa selling his wares. The next whiff of droid takes me to a pile of parts outside a mobster's apartment. I hurry from droid to droid, hunting for the gold one and the squat one. My hope begins to run out. If they're in the desert, I will have trouble finding them. Even with my goggles, that much yellow light quickly leaves me drained and hurting. Then, I smell it. Something new. An old speeder's exhaust, and with it the bright odor of droids left too long in the sun. They're not as close as I'd like, and by the time I get to the scent, they're gone. Probably hiding in one of the myriad labyrinthine buildings. I stalk the area outside Wu-Her's cantina and hear a fight within. Ponda Baba and other Zanagulan harassing outsiders. I hide in the shade as they lurch outside. Panda's arm held in Evazan's hands like he's in the middle of one of his disgusting surgeries. The odor of charred flesh makes my snout wrinkle in revulsion, and foul red blood still drips from the wounds. I slip in the door once they are gone, and lean against the wall, my hood pulled down. A strange scent rides the air. Something I've never smelled before. Like burning rock and cooked meat. Like lightning given life. I trace it to three humans and a Wookiee. It's that disreputable Han Solo. The new humans need passage to Alderaan for themselves. And two droids. I almost laugh. Do these men even know what secrecy is? They're wanted. This town is being patrolled by stormtroopers, but they announce their intentions in plain sight. It's almost too easy. But the droids aren't with them. So I hurry out of the bar and squat in a dark corner between the cantina and Han's junker ship. If their deal works out, and it will, because I know Han needs money and a reason to get off Tatooine, they will come this way. Soon, I'm rewarded for my efforts. The men walk by with two droids. One golden and one squat, as they hurry to the Millennium Falcon. My snout crinkles with delight, and I find a quiet place to calm my contact within the Empire. Thanks to the protocol droids that answer this channel, I'm able to speak in Kubazian, and it's a small delight to taste the words of home.
I found the droids, I say. Mos Eisley's spaceport, docking Bay 94.
A mechanized voice answers.
Roger. Will credit account after collection.
How I hate droids. My people communicate what they wish you to know, and humans communicate everything. But droids communicate nothing. I follow my quarry to make sure they're headed in the direction I've reported. They linger outside the ramp instead of hurrying onto the ship. I lean nonchalantly against the wall as the troopers appear to claim the droids.
Is this docking Bay 94?
One asks me.
Yes, that way, that way,
I say, even though in my excitement I've forgotten to speak basic. He understands well enough and hurries on. As blaster fire erupts, I run away. The scent burns the hairs in my snout, and the lights give me a headache. I am not made for this place. It is pleasant letting someone else do the dirty work. Back at the cantina, I order another drink at the bar. There's something fitting about finishing the bottle before I leave, as if giving myself concrete evidence that no Kubas remain on this dratted planet.
Two in a day,
Wu-Her asks, but I know he's not expecting an answer. He moves on, and I take a sip and consider my datapad. The credits should appear at any time, and then I will look around this cantina and select the least terrible smuggler to escort me home. The bulk of my savings paid for my daughter's message, so collecting this bounty is imperative.
The bounty's good, eh?
Labria comments, giving me the full benefit of his regal smile, showing only his pointed teeth against his red skin. For once, I respond honestly. Functional, but lacking in higher tones, I say in basic. The Devaronian shakes his head, ears going up in annoyance.
You know nothing,
he grumbles. Little does he know. A band on Kubindi has at least 3 times as many players as this simple biff grouping. And the intricacies of our music would soar over his horns. I was once an accomplished percussionist myself.
Perhaps you are correct,
I offer. I check my datapad, but still the credits aren't there. As I stare at the balance, a new message pings in. Droids avoided capture. Bounty not awarded, it says.
And that's it.
My snout deflates and sags with disappointment. I have a day or two, maybe mere hours, to secure enough credits to buy my way off this planet while the Imperial codes are still good. I scroll through the boards, looking for some new or previously hidden bounty I can pick up. Some easy little job to drop just enough credits into my account. It is not lost on you that back home on Kubindi, my clan is wealthy enough to buy this cantina and everyone in it. But my daughter's message cost everything I had, and I can't get off Kubindi. And I can't get a message to them. So I sit here, surrounded by dross, so close, and yet so far from saying goodbye to my mate, and seeing my grandchildren and children again.
Bad news, long snoot?
Libra asks. I shake my head. If he understood me, If he could read a tiny fraction of what I'm expressing, he wouldn't have to ask. But he looks at me and sees a hood, goggles, and a long snoot. Nothing more, nothing less. There are no good bounties, no simple requests for information, nothing that can be accomplished with only my senses and my cleverness. I need a job, I said to Labria. Something quick, something today. He looks at me with renewed interest, and I hear his teeth sliding in and out of place as he thinks.
Do you know the reader, the cretin?
He asks. I nod.
She needs a number two for a job. Tonight.
Why don't you take it then? Labria barks a laugh and sips his golden drink, considering.
Too much work.
Why has no one else taken the job? He glances at the bar in an assumptive way, and I produce a half cred. I've watched him enough in my time here to know that nothing is free.
It's against the Alliance. No one likes taking sides.
He sneers as he looks around the room.
The humans don't, I mean. One master is much the same as another.
He's wrong. That very assumption is what landed me here. My people lured by the Empire into thinking that the Alliance was our enemy. Alone in space, we could only believe what we were told. How wrong we were. Yet even knowing that the Empire has enslaved my planet and tried to turn me into a brainless drone, I need those credits. I need them more than I need righteousness. And besides, from my understanding of intergalactic history, a small assassination on a backward planet never did change the world. Tell her I'll do it, I say. Labria dashes off a message on his datapad.
It's done. She'll send you coordinates.
He sips his drink and considers me as if seeing me for the first time.
You know, some say you're the greatest spy in Mos Eisley's spaceport. Some say you're wildly wealthy. Some say you're greedy, unprincipled, and dirty, and that you do what you do for the pure joy of destroying so many well-laid plans. So tell me, Long Snoot, what are you really?
I stare at the bar for a moment, before realizing that he can't see my eyes through the goggles. Slowly, and with emphasis, I tap the bar with my finger. Labria chuckles and replaces my half-cred. I am very far from home, I say. Risking away the half-cred, I hurry outside to prepare for my last bounty.
Born in the Storm by Daniel Jose Older.
Stormtrooper Corps of the Imperial Army Division of the Imperial Military, Galactic Empire. Official Imperial Incident Report Form. Instructions.
Please fill out fully and completely. Details help. Sometimes seemingly small elements can change the whole story. As such, please don't leave anything out. Be thorough. Follow the instructions carefully and answer the questions asked in each section. Paint a picture. And remember, failure to comply with proper Imperial military protocol can result in disciplinary action, including docked pay, loss of equipment, expulsion, and/or summary execution. Remember also that this is an official imperial document, and any discrepancy between what you write and what actually occurred is an infraction of the imperial military protocol. Thank you for your service. Name:
Sardis Ramzan.
Operating number:
TD-7556.
Corps:
Stormtrooper.
Division:
Sand Trooper.
Unit:
Foot Patrol 7.
Commanding Officer:
Commander TD-110.
Location of incident: settlement, planet, region:
Mos Eisley, Tatooine, Outer Rim.
Were any other members of your detachment involved in this incident?
Oh, yes, very much so.
Which ones? Be specific.
Literally all of them.
Were any officers injured during this incident?
One can only hope.
Please list all officers injured during this incident.
I'd really rather not, actually.
Are you an officer? If no, skip the following question.
No.
Were you injured in this incident? Are all participants in the incident accounted for currently?
Absolutely the Kriz not.
What were the initial events that led up to the incident in question? Be specific.
Right. Well, I guess it starts in the Mos Eisley barracks then, right? We were sent as a specific designated detachment regiment by Grand Moff Tarkin to this armpit of a planet in the literal butt of the galaxy to recover some missing droids. At least, that's what I heard. They don't really tell us much, you know? Well, I guess you do know, don't you, since they equals you. But I digress and whatnot. There we were, bunked up in just our underskivvies, which, by the way, since we're on the subject, are all well and good when you're freezing your balls off on Faz or Renvar or something. But in the double sun deserts of Tatooine serve only to bake you thoroughly to a crisp and lodge sand in the most unmentionable and unreachable places. So, thanks for that. Also, the temp regulators in those helmets you gave us are an absolute sham. Like, not even remotely functional. So, you know, you might want to get on that or something. Anyway, there we were, schlanging about and waiting for run orders from 110. Commander TD-4445 had moved into the city proper with his mounted squad, according to their melodramatic outbursts on the comms. I really don't know what the Mounties are so fussy about. They have it made, if you ask me. While we futz around like holograms on the Dejarik board, these lucky moles get to roll nobly across the desert on dewbacks. And look, those animals, I can't explain it. There's something graceful about them. They just move like every particle of them is perfectly aligned and entirely free. They'll take you through a storm, over a river, into a building. They'll maul the criff out of anyone that gets in your way. They're basically a stormtrooper's best friend. Before you say anything else, yes, I put in to be in the Mounties, and no, I wasn't accepted. No, I don't know why, but I'm still pretty miffed. Anyway, I was actually sitting there pondering that, why I didn't get positioned in the Mounties instead of with this inept pile of foot patrol trash. And Tin Top was being a nuisance again, as I recall. He'd slipped TD-787 something that made him gassy, and TD-787 was about to wreck him, again, when old Craig spoke up. And the whole of Unit 7 knows that when Craig has something to say, you listen. Even though, if we're being honest, 99% of what that relic spews is unadulterated bantha piss. But whatever. It breaks the monotony, I guess. "Do you blokes know where we got our name from?" Craig says, all mysterious-like. TD-787 is stopped mid-lurch, like absolutely about to choke the useless life out of Tin Top, but instead, TD-787 turns and goes, "Because our helmets are shaped like buckets, I always figured." Everyone scoffed, because that would have actually been funny if he'd meant it as a joke, but TD-787 was born bereft of even the remotest sense of humor, so, well, it actually makes it even funnier that he was serious, honestly. Either way, we all had a good chuckle, except Craig, who scowled, the old clone's permanent expression augmented, and said, "Not that name, you cog!" "It's because we were born in the storm," Commander 110 said from the doorway. And then, because 110 always gotta say everything twice, the second time wistfully, "Born in the storm." I can't lie, though. He looked impressive standing there in his full body armor, helmet off, backlit by the twin Tatooine suns, his shadow thrown long across the barracks floor.
"Aye," Craig said, "the storm of history. As the galaxy transitioned from chaos to order, our regiment was created to maintain that order."
"That's one version anyway," Commander 110 said.
Even backlit, I could tell he was smiling some. Could hear it in his voice. He was having one of those patriotic sway type moments when the whole galactic empire seemed to sparkle in his eyes and whatever ridiculous mission was ahead appeared infinitely manageable. All part of the grand design. And that's all well and good, but there was sand in my butt crack and the day wasn't getting any cooler, so quite frankly, I wish he'd hurry up and get to the point. Which he then did.
"Run orders, boys."
Everyone groaned. 110 ignored us, wisely. "We're moving into Mos Eisley proper. The barracks are on the outskirts of town, apparently to discourage too much fraternizing with the locals, but like, fat chance, if you know what I mean. Also, outside of town equals closer to the endless barren infinity of a wasteland festering with sand people, banthas, and a million other ways to die. Also, sand. All the sand. All the sand ever." So, Mos Eisley proper didn't seem like so terrible a thing by comparison. If those droids had been wandering around the deep desert, they wouldn't have made it back to base in one piece, let's just put it that way. Bad enough you run off to some stinking bantha hole planet with secret plans or whatever on board, don't add insult to injury by making me deal with even more sand, you know? And anyway, the Dubaks were there. And maybe, well, a stormtrooper can dream. So, we geared up, put on our inefficient, technically archaic, and altogether butt-scratchingly uncomfortable armor, put on our absolute garbage-dump helmets that don't let us see a dang thing, and loaded up these E-11s you've given us, which require one to aim as far as possible away from what one's shooting at in order to have half a chance of hitting it. So, thanks for all that.
What actions did you take based on the initial events leading up to the incident in question?
Nothing. We just sat there. Like, really, my dear interrogative application system, what kind of Griffin question is that? 110 gave us the order to move, so we moved. If we didn't, we'd be summarily executed, remember? Or, long distance choke smashed by your beloved arch wizard woo-woo in chief. Hard pass on that option, thanks. So, we geared up, rolled out, and there we were in the heart of Mos Eisley, getting crispy beneath all those layers of armor and this giant black body sock, and quite frankly, craving a thirst quencher. And I don't mean the kind that actually quenches thirst. I mean the kind that dehydrates, in fact. A beverage. Specifically, one that frizzles, to be precise. Jawa juice, in case I wasn't clear. I wanted a damn drink. And look, we had no leads, really, so what's one direction or another in that rotting scum rat basin?
"I think they may have headed for the cantina," I said, sounding authoritative and not leaving any room for debate.
But of course, TD-787 wouldn't be TD-787 if he didn't play the contrarian at any given opportunity, so he chimes in with, "Well, what makes you think that, Sar?" And I was about to snap back at him when 110, Commander 110, I guess, holds up one hand all serious-like. "Look, I don't know if you've ever been to Mos Eisley, but it's crammed with about 8 million hard-up, squirming, slimy, writhing, multi-limbed, sometimes tentacled, seething, heaving, bleeding, literally frothing, demented, useless waste of skin and bone and sometimes gear and data. Yes, it's a spaceport, but if you're looking for the dead end of the galaxy and its denizens, look no further. So there are plenty of suspicious-looking droids. They hobble past, zip along on their rusty little wheels, stumble by through the sand-crusted streets. They wait outside of junk shops and currency exchanges, bleeping and burping and being their little self-righteous selves. I don't like droids, in case you weren't sure. They annoy me. Anyway, that's what made it remarkable that Commander 110 seemed to have such a strong feeling about this speeder coming our way with two droids, an old guy, and a kid driving. They were unremarkable to me in every way, really, but 110 gets his feelings about stuff and runs with it, and he's the one with the orange pauldron, not me, so whatever he says, I guess. We surround the speeder looking all heavy and serious, even though we're the ones with the blasters. However useless, they still would have made quick work of the kid and his obviously somewhat off-the-deep-end grandpa.
One Ted asks how long they've had the droids, and they say something. I wasn't really paying attention, to be honest, because we weren't that far from the cantina. And I figured if we could wrap this up quick and head over there, I could be slurping Jawa juice within the hour. Blam! But old 110 has other plans, of course. Because the Rebel Alliance is really going to rely on an ancient freak and a teenager who needs a haircut to ferry their top-secret cargo around. The esteemed Commander 110 demands their IDs. If you could see through these stupid buckets we wear, you would have seen my eyes roll so hard. All our eyes, probably, except TD-787, because annoying. Then the old guy's like, "You don't need to see his identification." And the first thing I thought was, whoa, is this geezer an Imperial? He just had that way about him, like he was one of us somehow, but busted and goofy and strung out. Maybe it was the accent. That thought really didn't last long, though, because the next thing that happened was that I was absolutely 100% sure that we did not need to see his identification. I mean, to be fair, it didn't seem that necessary in the first place, but listen, you would have had to hold me down and shove his scan docs in my face and probably take my helmet off if you really wanted me to see anything, if you wanted me to look at him. It was imperative that I not see them right at that moment. In fact, all I wanted was to get the Kriz out of there. And not just to get sizzled on some Jawa juice either. Seems Commander 110 finally came to his senses too, because then he says,
"We don't need to see his identification."
"Bless," I almost yelled, but I kept it contained. "These are not the droids you're looking for," old guy says. And he was right. He was so right. It was like, of course they're not. 110 agreed, and then old guy says that he can go about his business, and I'm like, yes, yes, old guy, say that. And 110 agrees again, word for word, in fact. "Move along," this remarkable little geezer says. Commander 110 nods.
"Move along."
And then, because he's 110 and he can't help himself, he repeats it for good measure.
What further actions did you take following the initial events surrounding the incident in question?
Well, we went and got sizzled on some Jawa juice, my guy. What do you think? At that point, we were already fed up. Of course, we finally get to the cantina, and there they are. No, not the droids we were looking for. Dubaks. Two beautiful, shining Dubaks. Females, I think. Just standing there, breathing in and out, and reflecting on their Dubak lives, taking in the suns. At that moment, to be honest, I didn't care about the droids or the Galactic Empire or even the Jawa juice. I just wanted to go up and lay my hand on that snout and close my eyes and just be still, you know? But the Dubaks being there also meant TD-4445's guys were around somewhere, so we had to go in and see what we could, lest another unit get the drop on us and deliver the droids instead.
"Look lively, boys,"
Commander 110 said. And Crag just chuckled. Then we go in that ruthless dinge pot and are instantly surrounded by various forms of star scum and asteroid excrement, the never-ending stench of cheap milk, and bodies that have been cramped into spaceships with no showers for far too long. First thing I see is an Ithorian, and he's looking jumpy, to be honest. I'm not even trying to smash heads like that, but this Ithorian seems downright shook when we walk in. I send him a scowl, which of course he can't see. But it doesn't matter. He'll be moving along soon enough anyway. The whole joint seems to tingle with the murmur of some mess that must have just gone down. One of those little eager-faced freaks with the beady eyes is mopping someone's blood off the floor, and I hear whispers and grunts about a lightsaber. A lightsaber? I'm tired, man. I'm just tired. The bartender points TD-787 and 110 toward a corner table where some cats involved in the mess were supposed to have been, and I try to take the opportunity to signal that I want a drink. The bartender's a surly scrug, though. He just scoffs and looks away. And then I notice Tintop has actually managed to get one. The damn fool's lifting up his bucket to steal a few sips, and I'm about to curse him out when I hear a polite little ahem from the seat next to me. There's a Tals sitting there. You know, one of those little gray, hairy things that looks like an Ewok that got punched in the face? It's sitting at the bar next to me, scratching its icky little proboscis and looking, I think, at me. Then it burbles something. I can't be bothered with languages I don't know, so I just shake my head. And then the bartender, speaking of faces that have been punched too many times, goes,
He says the droids you're looking for headed into the desert with some sand people.
Then, as if to seal the deal, he puts a drink down in front of me. I glance over at Tin Top, who's just guzzling at this point, and then across the room to where 110 Crag and TD-787 are hassling the band. I shrug. Then I look at the drink and the waiting Talls with its beady little eyes. Information recon, right? Does he know how long ago they left? I ask as I lift up the old Met and take a nice long chug. The gray guy squabbles some, and then the bartender says, "They went just before you lot walked in. Said they had a bantha with them."
"A bantha?"
Tin Top yells in a way that makes it clear he's well sizzled already. Then he gets a little too close to my ear and mutters,
"But can we trust the little fuzzbugger? You know this cantina ain't exactly Imperial friendly, Ram."
I shrug. At this point, I'm not sure how Imperial friendly I am myself, if we're being honest. Which we are, apparently. I hate my unit. I hate my uniform. I hate that I can be hauled out to any old galactic waste bin on a moment's notice just to annihilate some random one-celled troglodyte. It's the constant feeling that the world may be very, very beautiful somehow, if only one could remove the crap-stained glasses that come with being a member of this ridiculous army. Tin Top shrugs, too, because whether he agrees with all my deep inner sentiments about the Empire or not, Tin Top generally just can't be bothered, especially when he's toe up on the juice. Crag and 110 come back around to let us know there was no one over there but some smug-looking tool and his Wookiee, and that the band interrogation came up empty. We tell him the new info.
"Bugger,"
110 says as we shove our way through the crowd and out of the cantina.
"Crip."
"Describe the incident in question. Be specific."
Well, about that, once we left the cantina, everything started happening fast. First of all, those Dubaks were still there, just grazing and smiling even, maybe. Can a Dubak smile? I think so. They certainly seemed to see us, not a little. Immediately, TD-4445 comes up on the comm to be all,
"We're pursuing a lead that some rebels have commissioned a ship and are trying to get off Tatooine with the droids. Our intel says they're desert-bound with some Tusken Raiders,"
110 says.
"Who's your source?"
"Gurindon,"
comes the gurgled response.
"Gurindon the Kubaz?"
110 asks.
"Affirmative. He is following the suspects. We'll advise."
Look, I am not bigoted or nothing, but the Kubaz are a trash species. Period, point blank, no exceptions. So like, okay, a long-snouted, goggled armpit gave you some information. Are you gonna believe it? I rather think not, frankly. I mean, I'm not, anyway. I say as much to 110.
"Regardless,"
TD-787 blurts out, being punchable as always,
"that's a confirmed Imperial source. We have to follow up his lead first, right, Commander?"
Maybe it's the juice, but I almost just deck TD-787 right then and there. I'm pretty sure I'd have been acting on behalf of the whole squad if I had. Not for nothing. I mean, those Dubaks were right there. And as far as we knew, the rebels were getting away as we spoke, just vanishing into the never-ending sands of Tatooine. Commander 110 shakes his head, then nods, unhelpful as always.
"The Imperial lead,"
he mutters.
"We have confirmation."
TD-4445 suddenly garbles over the comm.
"The rebels are heading for the hangar. All units converge on docking bay 94.
"There's your answer,"
Commander 110 grunts, and then we're off. Before I even have time to object, tearing through the cluttered streets, pushing through a crowd of stinky Jawas. I know this is wrong. I can feel its wrongness all over my body. It's inescapable. But I'm a soldier, a stormtrooper. I'm the faceless enforcement fist of the Galactic Empire. What can I do about it? I shove along with my unit, trying to ignore the deep-down ache that tugs on me like a tractor beam back through the crowd to the front of the cantina where those Dubaks wait.
"This way,"
Crag yells, because he always has to be the one that knows everything. And then we're somewhere we had definitely just been. The winding, dusty walls and sandy alleyways and leering stairs seem somehow familiar. But this whole place looks like that, so who's to say?
"Now over here,"
Crag insists, and we follow. Because what else are we to do? We follow orders. It's the sum and extent of our existence. Say kill, and we will.
say die, and our arms fly up and take the blaster fire full on. Watch our pointless existence extinguished on command. This romp through these crumbling back streets sums up our entire sad lives pretty ruthlessly. It's clear now. None of us have any sense of where the hangar is, and it doesn't matter anyway, because the rebels are probably almost to the far edge of the city by now and about to breach out into the infinite sands.
Over there,
Craig says, and it seems like he's running out of steam, or maybe we're getting close. Then I realize we're definitely getting close because a growl of engines erupts all around us and I hear blaster fire from not too far away. Then some hunk of absolute junk hurls up above the buildings around us and launches out into the sky. The comm is thick with static and units yelling for backup, but I'm 100 clicks away. As soon as the junk ship took off, something in me let go. And I knew what I had to do. I don't know how, but I did. It wasn't even a conscious decision, to be honest with you. Before I realized I had made a move, I was tearing back through the streets. I don't even know how I made any sense of that dung heap of a city. I just plowed forward like some invisible thread was yanking me along. And then there I was, and there they were. Still outside the cantina, just where we'd left them. The two Dubaks, looking polite and slightly impatient, to tell you the truth. I was running. I must have been, because the closer one reared up a little and snarled as I got close, but then I wrapped one hand on the saddle, and I was up on it, and I pulled the restraining cord free, and we were off!
What were your actions in response to the incident in question?
We charged through the streets of Mos Eisley, me and the Dubak. We were one at that moment, an unstoppable wave of man and muscle, teeth and saddle. Smugglers and local denizens dived out of our path. Up ahead, the desert loomed, unfathomable and immense. There was something I was supposed to be doing, I vaguely recalled. Something urgent, supposedly. It didn't seem to matter, though. All that mattered then was the whisper of desert wind against my helmet, the thundering beast beneath me, the yawning maw of desert ahead. Rebels? Droids. That's right. At the edge of town, I slowed the beast down and lifted my macro binoculars. Sand and emptiness stretched for clicks and clicks ahead of me, interrupted only by an occasional hovel or comm tower. The beast stirred impatiently beneath me. It wanted the thrill of movement again. So did I. And then, there, on the horizon, the dim shape of a bantha shimmered against the bright sky. A few sand people stood scattered around it. They were moving over the crest of a dune, would soon be out of sight. I kicked my heels against the Dubak and together we launched out into the desert.
What were the initial results of your actions during the incident? Paint a picture.
It's funny you should ask that. The whole galaxy condensed around me, became the sand and dunes. The world became one, a singular scope of life as it stretched toward an emptiness in a never-ending cycle. The beast heaved beneath me, plunging forward toward that emptiness too. I took out my data pad, and I've used it to transmit this report, which is probably the last you'll hear from me. At some point, I wasn't wearing my gear anymore, and then the sun sent their soothing emissaries of light to dance across my skin, and the sand kicked up in a ferocious hellwind that swept out of nowhere and lit the world on fire with screaming and the brittle dust of the desert. And it was like a gentle, terrible whisper that this world I once thought to be dead is so alive. Just like me, so alive and born and reborn in the storm and absolutely free.
Lena, by Will Wheaton. Ryland climbed into the lookout and scanned the sky. The fighters were already in the air, ahead of the transport they were escorting out of the system. He knew he was doing the right thing. He knew Cameron and Rhea would take good care of Lena, be good mothers to her, and raise her as their own until they could be reunited. He knew it was too dangerous to keep her with him on Yavin, which was a legitimate military target should the Empire ever discover its existence. He knew that he could have gone with her, that nobody from his wing would have held it against him, that he could be holding his young daughter right now, as they climbed the edge of the atmosphere and toward relative peace and safety. Rylan knew that he was not the only person on the base. Hell, he wasn't the only one on duty at this moment who had lost something, given up something, made some sacrifice in service of the rebellion against the Empire. Knowing all of these facts did not make the moment any easier or any less painful. He wiped away tears, held his scanner to his eyes, and said goodbye to his daughter as he watched her transport kiss the top of the atmosphere and vanish into the darkness of space.
This is Gold Tower to transport Echo Delta One,
he said into his comm.
You've cleared the atmosphere and are a go for hyperspace. May the Force be with you.
He didn't believe in the Force, but today he would make an exception. He took his thumb off the button.
Take good care of my little girl,
he said softly. He sat down and wept.
18 hours earlier.
Ryland adjusted the camera and softly cleared his throat. He looked at Lena, sleeping restlessly in her crib. She'd thrown the covers halfway off her and had turned almost entirely sideways across the mattress. Her legs kicked gently and her eyes flicked side to side. Whatever she was dreaming about, he hoped it was something joyful. Maybe Fiona was there, with her. Maybe the three of them were together again. He would be careful that he didn't wake her. He turned his attention to the camera's lens and began recording.
Hello, Lena. I'm recording this message to you a few hours before you get on a transport to go to your new home with your aunts. I don't know how long it's going to be until I get to see you again, and it's important to me that you don't have to wait until then to know who you are, where you came from, and who your parents were. By the time you're old enough to see this and understand it, I hope that we're watching it together, and I hope that we're laughing about how silly I look right now. But since I joined the Rebel Alliance, I've said goodbye to a lot of friends, and I haven't been able to say goodbye to a lot more.
He took a deep breath to steady himself. Living under Imperial occupation was terrible, and the rebellion was not just right, but necessary. A lot of good people had given their lives, or worse, their freedom, in service of the struggle.
So,
he said with a smile he hoped wasn't too forced.
If this is how you're meeting me... Hi, sweetheart. I'm your dad. I'm 38 standard years old right now, and you're almost 2. I can't give you a lot of specific information, because if the Empire ever sees this, it could put us all in danger. But right now, we're on a rebel base, and you are sleeping right over there.
He grabbed the camera and pointed it at her.
That's you. You're so little right now.
He looked at her, listened to her soft breaths. He could feel that he was about to lose his nerve. Keep her with him at a place that he knew wasn't safe, but would at least keep them together. But if the reports about the Empire's battle station were true... He refocused his courage and turned the camera back on himself.
You and I came here when you were just 6 months old, right after your mother died. I'll tell you about her in a second, but first I want you to know where you're from. You were born in an underground mining colony on a moon in a place called the Outer Rim. There's no atmosphere on the moon, so some folks who live there now have never even been above the surface, and they'll never see the stars. But where you're going, you'll get to see the stars every night. Your mother and I aren't from there, and it probably isn't safe to tell you where we both came from. If we're watching this together, I'll tell you right now. Pause this and ask me. but we were both mechanics. I still am. I work on Y-wings instead of extractors now. And we met there when we worked in the same sector.
He held up a holo of Fiona and showed it to the camera.
This is your mom. Her name was Fiona. And she was my favorite human in the whole galaxy. Until you came along. She was clever and kind.
She understood how machines worked better than the people who designed them. And she could fix them faster than anyone I've ever met.
I loved her so much as she loved you. And she loved you more than anything. You have your mother's beautiful eyes.
But it looks like you got my big dumb ears.
Sorry about that.
He chuckled.
Your mom loved math and music. And when you were a tiny, tiny baby, she sang Mirror Bright to you every single day.
His voice caught in his throat, and his eyes watered.
He missed Fiona so much. Okay, so, the Empire came to our colony a few months before you were born. An Imperial officer assembled us in the Corps and told us the company we worked for had been taken over by the Empire. He said it was because the company wasn't meeting safety regulations, but that was a lie. He knew it, and we knew it. The Empire needed Dunium, and we had a lot of it. And if there's one thing you need to know and understand about the Empire, it is that it will take whatever it wants, whenever it wants it. The Empire will take everything you care about. Everything and everyone you love, if you let them.
He realized that he had clenched his fists and tightened up his shoulders. He willed himself to relax, looked down and opened his hands.
He touched the ring he still wore on his left hand as blood pumped back into his fingers. The Empire took your mom away from us, honey. An Imperial officer named Dugan killed her. Just because he could. I want you to know this so you never forget what we are fighting against and why I'm sending you away. I also want you to know that not everyone is courageous enough to stand up to the Empire. And those people, who we call collaborators, are just as bad as the Empire is. They may be even worse, because they should know better. It's because of a collaborator that your mom isn't here. His name was Corbin, and he had been our friend for years, until the Empire arrived. It happened so fast, Lena, you don't even realize it's happening. One day your friends are eating breakfast with you in the canteen, and when it's time for dinner, they're wearing an Imperial uniform.
Outside their room, a muffled voice announced the duty change. He would have to wake her up soon, dress her for travel, say goodbye. Corbin's new uniform fit him too well. It was like he'd always wanted to wear one because it was how he could feel important. But he wasn't important. He wasn't any more important than the blaster Dugan used to kill your mom.
I know I'm talking about him a lot. But I need you to know that the Empire exists because of people like Corbin, who are too weak or ambitious to stand up to people like Dugan. And the Rebellion exists because of people like your mom, who are willing to risk their freedom and their lives to stand up to them both.
Corbin didn't have a family before the Empire came.
And when he saw how happy your mom and I were to have you, made him jealous. He started doing little things to bother us, like making me work extra shifts and yelling at your mom that she couldn't have you with her in the canteen, even though everyone on our crew loved it when you were around. This went on until one day your mom just ran out of patience with him, and she told him to stop being a bully. Well, later that night, Corbin showed up at our quarters with Dugan, the Imperial officer in charge. Corbin had told Dugan that your mom and I were secretly rebel spies. We weren't rebels then, and Corbin knew it. We were just parents, trying to take care of our family, who were tired of being pushed around by someone with a little bit of power. I still don't know if Dugan believed Corbin, or if he just wanted to use your mom and me to frighten and intimidate the rest of our crew. But he and his loyalty officers ordered your mom and me to confess to being rebel spies in front of everyone. And when we didn't have anything to confess to, Dugan killed her. He just shot her right in front of me, as casually as turning off a light.
Ryland reached out and stopped recording. Did Lena really need to know all of that? If this was the only recording of him she would ever have, if she was going to watch this as she grew up, did he want to make her relive the death of her mother the way he did, night after night? He played the recording back, watched himself say, "The rebellion exists because of people like your mom, who are willing to risk their freedom and their lives to stand up to them both." And tapped record again.
All of us who joined the Rebel Alliance have lost something, or someone, or some place we loved. I've lost all three. And it isn't easy for me to say goodbye to you today. But I have to send you someplace where you'll be safe. Where you'll get to grow up and have a family if you want one. I hope that we don't need the Rebel Alliance by the time you're old enough to join it. But if we do, I want you to know that it's in your blood to fight back. You are your mother's daughter. I'll miss you every day. But I know that you'll be safe with your Aunt Rhea and Aunt Cameron. They helped our family escape from the Empire, and they introduced me to the Rebels. Now, I don't have time to tell you that part of the story, but you can ask them to tell it to you when you're ready to know. They love you very much, and they're going to take you to a planet called Alderaan, which is far away from any fighting. You'll be safe there. You can grow up and make friends and have the kind of life I've always wanted you to have. I'll fight for you as long as I have to, and I'll see you soon. I love you so much, Lena, and I miss you already.
He stopped recording and saved the file. Ryland walked over to his daughter's bed and put his hand on her shoulder.
Sweetheart,
he said gently,
it's time to wake up.
18 hours later. When his watch was over, Ryland declined an invitation to join some of the pilots from Blue Squadron in the canteen and took a transport back to his quarters. He lingered at the door, his hand heavy as he lifted it to key the entry code. For the first time since they had arrived from Burnin Khan a year ago, he would open it to find an empty room on the other side. He'd been standing there for several minutes when Maul Hastur, their neighbor, walked by. She paused and put her hand on his shoulder.
You did the right thing, Rye,
she said.
I know,
he answered.
The Force is with her,
Maul said.
It's with us all.
Thanks, Maul. I hope you're right.
He typed in his code and went inside. The door hissed closed heavily behind him.
Fully Operational by Beth Revis. A weapon was meant to be fired. Every military man could tell you that. Treat all weapons as charged. Never assume a blaster was set simply to stun and not kill. General Cassio Tagg, chief of the Imperial Army, knew that. As he walked the corridors of the greatest battle station ever built in this or any galaxy, he was deeply aware that he walked through the heart of a weapon. Power simmered beneath the dunium. He had not been aboard the Death Star when it had gone through its initial test firing on Jedha, but he joined soon after and witnessed Scarif. He paused now, a hand on the sleek metal wall, remembering the rumble of power as the Death Star charged and fired. It had been a subtle vibration, something he might not have noticed had he not been looking for it. That was a mark of how big the battle station was. It could kill off half a planet, and most of the people who resided within the station wouldn't even notice. A credit to Director Orson Krennic, to be sure. Even when the Joint Chiefs had questioned the validity of such an enormous and expensive weapon, Krennic had insisted it was both possible and needed. Tag had never really liked Krennic. He'd found the man obsessive. But perhaps it took a man obsessed with firepower to make something like the Death Star. And a man such as Grand Moff Tarkin to take it. Tag paused now, his hand still brushing the metal wall of the corridor. He straightened. Without meaning to, he'd arrived at the meeting room early. His thoughts, lingering on Krennic, recalled the last Joint Chiefs meeting in this room. The one where Krennic had insisted the Death Star could do more than destroy a small city like Jedha. Krennic had shoved his chair aside, standing up and beating a fist on the table. Tag, two seats down, had both admired the man's passion for the battle station and been disgusted by the childish way in which he presented it. In the end, Krennic got what he wanted. Another test fire. A larger one. Now, the seat two chairs down from Tag's was empty. A weapon was meant to be fired. You just had to make sure you were on the correct end of it. Tag continued past the meeting room door with purpose in his strides. He had a private office that branched off the tactical room, and there he brought up the reports and footage of Scarif. Krennic had ever been a man too mercurial for a leadership position. He had guts, true, but he'd relied too heavily on them. Tag was a man of graphs, of data, of facts and information. They were cold, but they were true. And the truth of the matter was that the Empire had a problem. The surveillance droids had been able to transmit some of the rebel activity on the surface of Scarif prior to being destroyed, and Tag had carefully compiled the data. Unlike the little partisan units scattered throughout the galaxy that caused middling annoyance at best, Scarif showed a concentrated effort. It showed communication. Take 10 black hive ants and put them in separate jars, and they could do nothing. But put them in the same jar, and they vibrated in harmony until the glass shattered. Hive ants weren't sentient exactly, but they were destructive. The same could be said of the rebels. Tag waved his hand, dismissing the Scarif footage. He turned his attention to the list of names in the Imperial Senate that he had compiled. Some were obvious. Mon Mothma had a price on her head for being too blatantly treasonous, and Bail Organa would soon as well if he did not curb his rebellious tendencies. The man slipped through the political world like oil over water, skimming close to insurgency and relying on legalese and luck. Malicious compliance was still compliance, but it wouldn't be long before the senator slipped on his own sharp edge. But there were others. Lingering opinions, doubts against the Emperor. They were separated in their little jars now, but Mon Mothma's dramatic escape from the Senate had opened the lids. And the Senate was abuzz. And then there was Scarif. Tag kept coming back to it. The transmission that had leaked. The Death Star plans. The stolen data somewhere out there in the galaxy. A threat hidden in the vast emptiness of space. It was hard to think that the very battle station he now stood in, so solid, so powerful, could have any weakness. But Tag forced himself to look at his data, not the solid walls around him. A restless Senate here, a group of targeted, communicating rebels there, and that damn data tape. It wasn't hard to connect the pieces. Tag stared at the data, sorting it in his mind. He debated whether or not he dared ask the Emperor for access to the plans stolen on Scarif. All other copies had been sealed under the highest security. Security so high that even he, as chief of the Imperial Army, was denied access. He understood the concern, but knew if he could examine the data there, he might find something before the rebels did.
General Tag?
A junior officer's voice sounded through the intercom. Yes, Tag replied impatiently.
Admiral Motti to see you.
Tag grunted his affirmation, and the door to his office slid open.
Thought I'd find you here.